You are tuned into Business Sense on Adventist World Radio, powered by SID Media.
When you think of a leader, I'm pretty sure the first thing that comes to your mind is someone who occupies positions, right? Or who occupies a position. But when I think of tonight's guest, my definition of leadership absolutely changes. I think of someone who shifts cultures, institutions, and quite frankly, entire generations. Our shapeshifter tonight is one of those rare voices. Tabia Kabinde is not just a professional in diversity, inclusion, and transformation. She is a force of transformation herself. Over 20 years of experience, accolades that read like chapters in a legacy. Businesswoman of the Year from the South African Businesswomen Council, the Founders Cup from APSO, and beyond the awards, a trail of companies, individuals, and industries that stand taller because she walked in? Come on. Her journey is proof that the true art of leadership is not in the titles, but in the courage to ask, who gets left out of the room and how do we bring them in? Tonight, we are honored to sit at the table with a woman who has made space at countless tables for others. Tabia, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. What an intimidating introduction.
Come on. Not you. Not you. I'd love for you to take us back. What was little Tabia like?
A girl from the township, from Soweto.
Yay.
Very full of life. Mm. Very uncertain in some ways, okay, based on her own personal life and her own personal story. Never dreamt of being who she turned out to be, okay, in a lot of ways. And all of that is really to the glory of God.
Mm. And what are some of the defining challenges you faced growing up? And how did they shape your resilience? I mean, if you had never imagined of being this person, but you became that person, you must be quite something. So what were you up against growing up?
I think one of the first things that I can say that I was up against, and it's not only unique to myself, but to a whole generation of young girls my age at that time, was not having agency. So black children generally did not have agency. We grew up in a culture where children were to be seen and not heard, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We grew up in a culture where we were told that it's not okay to think that you're all that. You can never walk tall and feel that you can occupy space. The space was always defined by somebody else, and you were just following while others defined the space. Mm. I think also the apartheid legacy brought that perception that if we don't fight hard enough, we may amount to nothing. And there was always that threat that one would not amount to to anything.
Yeah.
So when you get to a place where you see that you are not who you thought you would become, it's humbling.
Yeah.
And yet very exciting. Mm-hmm. Growing up in an environment where safety, well, it's more unsafe right now, hey? Mm-hmm. But even at that time, we felt just as vulnerable.
Yeah.
So yeah, those were some of the challenges.
Is this backdrop what drew you to inclusion, diversity, and transformation?
I think so, in some ways.
Yeah.
I was very, when you grew up in those days, it's not like children today, right? We grew up being very cognizant that we're underprivileged, being very cognizant that we're being discriminated against. Yeah. I mean, I remember one day we're traveling to Limpopo and my father walked into a shop to buy meat, you know, and we innocently just followed him. Mm. And he was told that he's not allowed in the shop.
Yeah.
He must go and buy from the window. you know? Mm. So those things were a reality. It was things that we were confronted with every day.
Yeah.
Seeing your father as the superstar in the house and a person to be reckoned with and seeing him being shriveled up to, you know, to nothingness, you know. So those realities were very stark for us when we grew up. Whereas today, my sense is that young black children or black girls and boys do not have to contend with that reality. Yes, discrimination is still alive, but you never have to believe that you are that small.
Mm.
Whereas at the time, it was drilled into us and we believed that we were that small.
Yeah. You know, what you're saying is so interesting. I've got a niece who's 19 now, right? And she, when she was younger, I'm pretty sure she's matured and grown now to realize how faulty her thinking was. When she was much younger, she used to say, "Nani, I cannot believe that a father of a home or a man would get into a taxi with his family. Aren't fathers supposed to be driving?" And I'm like, what? What? You know, for her, the norm is a family is in a car that is driven by a father. What do you mean a man is getting into a taxi? And so for you, the awareness was how unprivileged you were or underprivileged you were. And for her, the opposite is true. The awareness is privilege and maybe not so much. Maybe for her, she's also unaware of how privileged she is, but everybody else that is underprivileged is like a shock to her system.
Exactly. Exactly. You know, and I mean, we didn't just face discrimination from a racial perspective.
Yeah. Yeah.
We faced it from a socioeconomic perspective. We also faced it from a gender perspective where, you know, young girls were designed for certain careers.
Yeah.
You know, you couldn't dream outside of the frame that was, you know, that was defined by society at that stage.
Mm.
And as we, so I just watch how this world has changed so much for women and for black people in particular, you know.
20 years. As far as my research went, that is how much your career spans. I'm pretty sure it could be more. When did you start to then dream? Because there must have been a catalyst out of that mindset, out of that environment, and into the woman that we now see and hear from. When did you begin to dream? At what point did the dream happen and then materialize?
So I'm trying to think of the defining moments.
Yeah.
So one of them was, I remember I was doing Standard 2. That was 1974.
Mm.
And at the time, black people did not dream of getting onto a plane, you know? And I remember we flew down to Durban. It's actually quite a funny story because I remember that at assembly, we were actually, my brother and I were called to the front, and it was announced to the whole school that we had flown on an aeroplane, you know? And those things began to create a sense of possibilities for me, right? I then, in 76, I was doing Standard 5. And with the uprisings, my father took me to a boarding school. And when I arrived there, for the first time, I actually realized that I was much younger than my cohorts.
Okay.
You know? Most of them were 2 years older than me. So I started school when I was 4 years old, turning five.
What? What?
And getting to Form 1 at that stage, which is the equivalent of grade 7 now, and being in boarding school, being the small child amongst much older people, some people who were even married, they're done teaching. They've come back to do their high school to get to matric. I actually realized that I was in some ways very special. You know, I started realizing that I have certain gifts. And I couldn't articulate it at the time. I didn't know what it was, but I knew there was something special about me.
Yeah.
And at that point, looking at my academic achievements and looking at how teachers and even students responded to my performance, it's almost like the light came on that I was a special child. You know, and I mean, I'm by no means a genius. Get me right. So I'm a psychologist, right? So I know I've done assessments. I know that my IQ is not that of a genius.
Yeah.
But there was, I think it was a blend of my EQ and my IQ, right? That made me special. My ability to bounce back.
Yeah.
My ability to thrive, even in the most difficult of situations.
Yeah.
You know, and I recognized that. And then I started dreaming. Then when I was doing Form 3, which I think now is called grade 10.
Yeah.
So I need to say that already I'm sure by now you would get a sense that with me having been on a plane when I was doing in 1974, I was pretty privileged, right? So I came out of a home of privilege, and I need to put it out there because sometimes we don't acknowledge that we had certain gifts that were outside of ourselves.
This is true.
You know, that God gave us certain things that a lot of other people who were probably more intelligent than us didn't have access to. So I had access to a lot.
Yeah.
So when I was doing Form 3, I went for an interview in a private school, and it was a girls' school, a very elite school, right? My father took me there for an interview, and I went the following year to repeat my Form 3, right? It was a white school. They had a quota of 7 black girls. It was a girls' school. So I was one of 7 black girls in the school up to the time when I matriculated. So they maintained the quota of 7.
Yeah.
And at that point, what was strange is that I was leading in the school that I'd been to previously. And I came to this place and I was like literally almost failing, you know, and again, but the resilience kicked in. And so all of those things told me that I was special. Except for the fact that when I got to that school, I actually realized that I don't understand what privilege is. I was far from privileged. I was literally the low class of the low. I was at the bottom of the dustbin. And yet, people who looked at me from the township saw a very privileged girl. And talking about the work that I do in transformation, I think that's where I actually realized that I had a fight in me. So at that time, there were no IQ tests. Please stop me if I'm going on for too long.
No, please go on.
There were no IQ tests that were standardized for black people. They were standardized for white, English, and Afrikaans speaking people. And because I was in a white school, I was put through an IQ test. And it was quite strange, you know, and I mean, now that as I grew up, I began to understand what was happening. Because after these assessments, I sensed that there was a problem. All the teachers would come into the class and it would be like, Tabea, are you still with us? Do you understand?
Oh.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it was quite clear that I see it now, but then I didn't, you know. I had not done well, but of course you can't take South African children now and put them through a UK assessment.
No,
they will not do well.
It's not
and it
work.
Was exactly the same thing. It's not going to work, you know. And with that came a lot of pain, a lot of not feeling included. Also, you know, compounded by the fact that in terms of socioeconomic status, my family was not that privileged. My father was a hard worker. He would put together the money to take me to that school.
Yeah.
But I was by no means at the level at which most kids were at in terms of privilege.
Yeah.
So looking back, I realized that those were quite defining moments in terms of which the career, in terms of the career that I would follow. I also remember that when I was doing my undergrad and one of my majors in psychology, whenever we would study with other students and we talk about IQ tests, still at that point, they were not standardized for black people, right?
Yeah.
I remember distinctly that I would say, to them that those assessments are waiting for Tabia to come and create them. I remember distinctly saying those words. Don't worry, guys. Those assessments are waiting for Tabia to come and create them.
Yeah.
You know? And that's how big I started dreaming. You know? So whilst it was there were very painful experiences in the journey, but there were also very defining moments.
Yeah.
They defined where I would end up, how big I could dream.
Mm.
And also, I had insight into my own personal resilience.
Mm. And talk to us then about the time that you begin to get into the space of psychometrics then, because you had already decided that these are waiting for me. I'm going to be the one to do it. How did you then formalize it?
So it's actually very interesting. And some of these things are coming to my mind as I speak to you right now. So I go on, I do my undergrad, I go on to do my honors in psychology, and then I do my master's at UNISA.
Mm.
Again, at that point, there were 7 people in class. I was the only Black person.
Yeah.
Right. And so we learn about psychometrics and whatever, quite insightful. But again, I want us to understand that it is privilege that put me here, right? The reason why I could compete successfully with 7 other white people was privilege, right? It was because somehow I had been assimilated into a white culture previously, and I could fit in this room, okay? So then after that, when we're supposed to do our internships, UNISA has placements. By that time, I'm married. I had a child. I'm married. I'm staying in Attridgeville in the township. It's pre-democracy.
Yeah.
I don't have a car.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a number of placements. You know, interestingly, whenever I went to class, as you go up the UNISA hill, so it's almost like a full-time program.
Mm.
As you go up to the hill to get to UNISA,
yeah,
a lot of the people, the students that were in class with me, would pass me by. And there's another lesson that I learned in that.
Mm.
That when you are within a group of people that you're that are similar to you, so mm-hmm. a whole lot of Black students
mm-hmm.
would be walking up the hill to get to class. My white colleagues didn't see me.
Mm.
So they would drive past me because they just saw a group of Black people. So they didn't stop to give me a lift.
Yeah.
So we get to a place where we're supposed to be placed for internships. And at that time, UNISA had only one placement in Pretoria. And remember, I don't have a car.
Mm.
And guess where that placement is?
Yo.
One military hospital.
Yo.
So I land up in the South African Defense Force.
Yeah.
And it was just functional. It was as a result of the fact that the other placements were in Sterkfontein. They were in Tara, which is in Joburg. And I mean, I didn't have transport, but I could, by bus, get to one military hospital.
Mm.
There was transport that took cleaners and other people of other ranks in the military, that Black people there. So I could get to work without much difficulty. So I ended up at one military hospital.
Mm.
And worked as a therapist. So, I didn't get much involved in psychometric assessments except for clinical purposes.
Okay.
So I did this. But then after that, it's the referendum. I don't know if you would remember the referendum. So the white South Africans had to vote yes or no for democracy in South Africa, and they voted yes. It was quite significant. And at this point, I need to mention that in the psychology department, again,
yeah,
I was the only Black person, the only Black intern in the room, right? It mm-hmm. was a very Afrikaans environment. And I had to learn Afrikaans. I had to learn to do therapy in Afrikaans. So those were some of the obstacles that I had. I would walk around before I started wearing uniform. I would walk around and little girls whose fathers were in the military would come up to me and say, hello, OC. So OC in Afrikaans is almost like a derogatory word for a domestic worker,
yes,
right?
Yes.
And even in therapy, you know, kids would ask me when I was doing child psychology, they would ask me if I'm an OC. You know? But fast forward, after the referendum, we end up in a place where the different armed forces have to be integrated. And as this process is happening, a team of psychologists are engaged to demobilize and to also do diversity management within the military. Different armed forces that were fighting on different sides are now coming into one and are now going to work together side by side as colleagues, right? Yeah. You can understand the temperature, the anger, the resentment, the fear, the discrimination that's even, you know, it doesn't mean if there's legislation that says today we are equal, then we're automatically equal. So part of our mandate as this group of psychologists was to do diversity workshops to help to integrate the different armed forces into one armed forces.
Yeah.
So I start doing the diversity work right within the military and helping with the demobilization process. And during that time, APSA was then founded, and APSA had originally been a number of different banks that you may not even recognize. It was Falls Trust Bank, Allied Bank, and now they're amalgamating to become APSA Bank, Amalgamated Banks of South Africa.
Yes.
So I get poached to come and do the same process in the bank. And it was at that point that I started using the skills I had learned in the military to now facilitate integration and you know, bringing people together. And now we're starting to talk about things like employment equity, affirmative action, and bringing in Black people who were in exile, Black people that were learned in our country, bringing them at occupational levels where previously there had not been any Black people. And at the same time, working with people who were in Volkskas. Now, you must understand that these banks were created for the Afrikaner. It was the RDP of the Afrikaner.
Yeah.
Something that is not acknowledged today, right? And now these people have held on to power, they've held on to privilege, and now they're having to share it. So guess who's doing these sessions for them?
You.
It's a Black girl. Right? Black girls are doing that. I was doing it with another lady who was in exile as well.
Yeah.
Who was a social worker. So we did those workshops, and it was, again, very defining. Not only was I assisting people to work on their unconscious biases and their stereotypes, to work on their process of healing, I was also trying to heal during that time.
Of course.
From my own history, you know, and my own past, and working through what had happened. So it was a very difficult time. You're trying to facilitate the healing of others, but you're also working in their shoes, going through the healing yourself. So it was quite an interesting and difficult time. I then get approached by SAB then to come and do assessments.
Yeah.
For recruitment and development purposes, right? And then I'm reading this book at the time. It's called Empires of the Mind by a guy called Dennis Waitley. I don't know if people can still find this book, but that book changed my life.
Yeah.
And that book, one of the statements that it said was, control your destiny or someone else will. And it was yet another defining moment for me. I realized at the time that I could do some consulting work with SAB and leave my employer and control my own destiny. And so I did. So I left and I started consulting. And I started working with psychometric assessments. I started working with IQ tests. I started working with all sorts of assessments. And I started inputting into some of the assessments that we now have as a country and using new tools.
Yeah.
Of psychometric assessments, identifying that instead of testing for IQ, we could test for learning potential, right? And being part of the work of crafting environments where people would price learning potential higher than IQ. So I come back to the dream and I start working on assessment tools that would redefine what the standard is.
Yes.
Very interesting times.
Yes.
And then beyond that, then went on to be involved in a joint venture where we were recruiting for the IEC at the time. It was just before President Thabo Mbeki became president. We were leading up to those elections, right? And I also used assessments to recruit, and the rest is history. That's how I started being in business.
Oh man! And how has that journey been? How has consulting been?
It's not an easy journey. And we often talk about it, and that's one of the myths we need to debunk.
I'm glad you're going there, yeah.
So consulting, for a lot of people, is not a business. So I'm going to define what business is.
Okay.
But let me start here.
Yeah.
If you are working for your money by hours, right? So if there's, in a month, you get to work for, let's say, 15 days. And the income that you make is dependent on the hours that you've given in. Right? You've put in the hours, and in return, you get the reward of the hours you put in.
Yeah.
That is not a business. That is being self-employed.
Yeah. You just traded your 9 to 5 for 24 hours.
Yeah. Right?
Yeah.
A business is when you make money, even when you're sleeping. When you can go away for a week and the business keeps running, now you're in the business. Before that, you're just self-employed. Right? And so the move from being self-employed to running a business is a very interesting journey.
Yeah.
Because these are things that nobody teaches us. You see, way back when, there was no conception of what business was about. People looked at you and thought you're in business. You were not in business.
Yeah.
You were just self-employed.
Also, who could have taught us those principles
when
we were all the way in Soweto? Yeah.
Right?
We were all the way outlined.
Yeah. So those were, that was the difficulty. And even to this day, I laugh when when people say to me, give me some money. And I say, I don't have money, you know? And then people are like, but yourself, how can you not have money, right? And that's another lesson for us and something that we're not taught, that a business is a legal entity on its own.
Separate to you.
Right? Separate from me. I can't go into the bank account and keep taking money and keep taking money out of there. Now I've run out of money. I go and take money out of there and then hope that the business will remain sustainable.
Actually, you should get arrested because you're stealing.
Right? And I can't drive the car of my dreams using business money. I can't flaunt a drip that is labels.
Yeah.
Because I run a business. And those are the lessons that you learn on the journey from being self-employed to running a business. That as a legal entity, it needs to sustain itself. So even as I draw my salary, I need to leave some for everybody else that works in the business and for sustainability. You know, a lot of the time today we talk about sustainability. And we talk about it from the perspective of environment. But as you grow in business, you start understanding that there are concepts such as the King Four, and what are the principles around sustainability?
Yes.
What are your fiduciary duties as a director of a business? It's lessons that I didn't learn in class because I learned to be a clinical psychologist.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness.
I did not learn business management.
Yes. I was speaking to an entrepreneur yesterday. And I was saying, because he was saying, I'm good at what I do. And I'm like, sometimes that is our trap. That is our downfall. The fact that we are so good at what we do, but we are bad at business. And those two things are different.
They're totally, totally different.
Yeah.
So as part of my journey, I need to acknowledge that I met two white ladies that were looking for a black partner because BEE was the thing.
Of course.
At the time.
Of course.
And they had a history of understanding what business was like.
Mm-hmm.
What does it mean to be in business?
Mm.
So they pulled me into business and I become an equal shareholder and partner as well as director.
Mm.
And I start learning business.
Yeah.
I start learning business. But in the process, there's also further lessons to be learned,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
Lessons about how different we are.
Yes.
And how one needs to understand people's intentions.
Mm.
So we were three partners. And for the one, I became a real partner. For the other, I became a means to an end.
Mm.
Right? Because if you don't have a good scorecard, you can't get certain business.
Yeah.
So it depends on how people position in their minds why they're bringing you in.
Mm.
Are you adding value or are you a means to an end? And I believe that for one of the partners, I was a means to an end. And when she realized that I had agency, it was difficult to deal with me.
Yeah.
Because now this thing could speak.
Yeah, yes.
This thing had an opinion.
Imagine that. The audacity.
Right? The audacity.
Yeah.
Right? And God, in his mercy, put me in that place because he was going to work out something very good.
Mm.
And so this person, who was the initial founder of the business, looked at me that way. And when I started becoming something that she didn't expect that I would be,
mm-hmm,
it became a challenge for her.
Sure.
And I remember the turning point of my disempowerment in the business, as well as the turning point of the definition of our relationship, was when we sit in a meeting. And she said the following words, I will instill the fear of God in you.
Sorry?
I will instill the fear of God in you.
Said to an equal shareholder.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
But you need to understand that.
Yeah, in her eyes, you were not that.
In her eyes, God was not God.
Yo.
She was God.
Ooh. Ooh.
So that's what she meant by that comment.
Mm.
That was such a defining moment you cannot understand.
Mm.
Not in business, in my spiritual life.
Mm.
Because I sat up and thought to myself, excuse me?
Yeah.
You don't know who God is.
You don't.
And I have an idea of who he is.
You mean the one who put me here?
The one who put me here, right?
Yeah.
And immediately, it just changed the whole dynamic. I immediately felt empowered because the words, the Lord is my helper.
Mm.
I shall not fear.
Mm.
What can men do to me?
Yeah.
Hebrews 13, verse 6
mm.
just sprung up in my mind.
Yeah.
And it just changed the dynamic. Fast forward. I fired her from the business.
Oh, how the tables turned.
You know, between me and my partner, we worked so hard and we ended up dismissing her from the business. And for me, much as there were a lot of tears that I went through at that moment, I actually realized how God was determined to make himself known to me through that journey.
Yeah.
Right? And it was a very powerful, powerful journey. And she was this third partner that left was a huge catalyst in me rediscovering who God is in my life.
Yeah. You know, it's so interesting that our purpose becomes the very thing we are tested in most. And to think that for you, it's always been about inclusion. It's always been about transformation. It's always been about equality, essentially, diversity. And here you find yourself in a place where you have the opportunity to not enforce it, but embody it and lead an organization in that capacity. It's being challenged. You are being challenged.
Absolutely. And it was such a beautiful story, because you cannot preach something that you haven't bought.
No, no.
So when you're sitting in a room where people feel disempowered, you can dig deep to a time when you felt that disempowered. When
you
felt that fearful of the other, you know? And it was a gift. I didn't realize it then. It was going to be a gift for the work that I did, you know? And what's more important is that God gave me a partner that became a sister. We have been partners for over 25 years. A white girl from a place called Caledon in the Cape became my partner, my sister, you know, an auntie, a person that I love so dearly, because she saw beyond my color. She saw beyond the skin color. She saw the character.
She saw competence.
You know, and she enabled me to become me. And yet I also did the same for her. Because this challenge was not only my challenge, it was our challenge.
Yeah.
You know, so we've grown in leaps and bounds, and we've trusted in the Lord, and the Lord has just been so good to us. Remember, we ended up in a court battle, a long court battle around the partnership, the business, and all of that. And I remember one day our telephones were disconnected as a result of this dispute. The third partner, because she started the business, she's the one who owned the telephone lines, to disconnect the lines. And our business is dependent on telephones.
Of course.
And we were sitting there and we were so distraught and like, you know, it was just not going well. And I remember my partner saying to me, Tabia, let's pray.
Yeah.
You know what? God is faithful. God is faithful. So we had been talking about this, and the lawyers had been fighting about the telephone lines. We hold hands and we pray. Believe you me, as we say, amen.
Oh, no. Gring,
the phone
ring.
The phone rings. So how good is our God? So God starts teaching us.
Ooh.
You know, there's a scripture that says, I'm the Lord who teaches you how to profit.
Ooh.
God starts teaching us and taking us on a journey of how to profit. But above all else, he teaches us how to be fully reliant on him. And that's the story of our business. In our business, we say that God is our CEO.
Yes.
None of us occupy the CEO seat. We are directors in the business. The CEO seat belongs to God. Our business is run on godly principles. Yes, we fall, we make mistakes, but we're always cognizant that this is a business that belongs to God, and God will drive it. When we go through hard times, we know God is there. We're afraid, but we do not feel destroyed. And God always come through. And the biggest lesson for us has been to look at our business as a vehicle of empowering and preaching through our business, by the way we treat our employees, by the way we extend love and care, by how we conduct our meetings. We start our meetings with the word we pray. That's part of our culture. And it is a business where anybody has a right to call even the leadership to order. So it's a beautiful story and it's a continuing lesson. And I think I must say that I've experienced God's love and I failed to perfect my love for him. But the Holy Spirit continues to work in me as he seeks to help me to become more loving of God's ways.
Oh, I actually, as you were speaking, had to look up the verse because I hadn't heard it before. Isaiah 48:17. This is what the Lord, your Redeemer, the Holy One of Israel says. I am the Lord, your God, who teaches you to profit, who leads you in the way that you should go.
Amen.
You know, as somebody who's in business as well, this is so empowering to me. And I've heard a couple of CEOs say that God is a CEO. And I've always wondered, if God is a chief executive officer, what is your role then? Because I would love to believe that he empowers us. He gives us the wisdom to make decisions. So if he is the CEO, what is our role?
Our role is to be led and to be his representative in the business.
As you would in any corporate organization, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. It is to be humble enough to understand that he understands business more than you do.
Ooh.
To understand that he knows the external variables that you don't even see.
Mm.
And to understand that you are so inadequate. So inadequate that you should never feel that you're the biggest person in the room. There's someone bigger. And in the way in which you conduct yourself as a leader to communicate that message in the way you do business, always. I will tell you something. I've been in business for the longest time. I think, yeah, it's close to 30 years now or 20 something years that I've been in business and I've been self-employed for a number of years.
Mm.
But I can tell you without a doubt that I don't feel that I'm the best or that I cannot do without other people.
Yeah.
I always feel that I need my team as much as they need me.
Mm-hmm.
I always feel that there's certain territory that when we go to, we cannot go without being clothed in our spiritual armor. And those are lessons I've experienced going without my spiritual armor.
Yo.
And I've come back wounded.
Ooh.
And I've learned that I need to clothe myself and I need to ask for favor and I need to walk in and be cognizant of his presence in every situation. In the years that I've been in business, I've never paid a bribe. Never paid a bribe.
Yeah.
I've walked away from bribes. I've walked away from favor.
Yeah.
Because I've always, one of the things, and it's even worse for us as women, because in this business world, they don't just ask for money. They ask for you, for your soul. Right?
Yeah, yeah.
And I've always been very cognizant that the minute I do that, I'm disqualifying what I'm able to do. Because people look at me and they say, she got that just because she did 1, 2, 3.
Oh, because if there are news that are going to spread, it is those.
Exactly. Phew. And I always want to feel that I've earned everything by God's grace, you know, that I did not bribe my way into any favor.
Mm-hmm.
And it is such a good feeling to be in that place because you sleep at night.
Yeah.
I sleep at night.
You pray with a clear conscience.
Oh, I tell you, it is so fulfilling and it is such a gift that I know that even more prosperous businesses don't have it. Mm. They don't have the gift of sleeping at night. You know, and I have it. And I feel blessed for how God has given me so much favor.
Yeah.
Recognizing that I have my own inadequacies, I have my own imperfections, I still have my chips on my shoulder of certain things, but God has carried me. And sometimes I look back and I don't know how we got here.
Yo.
I don't know how we got here.
Yo. Is there anything you would have done differently in your journey, knowing what you know now?
I think I would have trusted God more.
Ooh, and possibly sooner?
Possibly a lot sooner.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think some of the wounds that I got was because I sat in the CEO role and took the decisions without him. You know, so one of the biggest lessons is to trust God more, to sleep even when things are not going well, to know that he's got this, you know, to know that in the current moment, I should worry about just what I can deal with right now. His word promises that tomorrow will take care of itself. He promises that he will look after us. And I think I would have had a more joyous journey in doing this if I trusted him sooner.
Yeah. What parting words do you want to leave with our listeners tonight, especially young professionals who are navigating an ever-changing world? And I know that when you were younger, it was a completely different world to now.
Mm-hmm.
But having seen that and living through this, what is the wisdom that you would impart on young professionals in this day and age?
So one thing I would say is my father is an amazing man, my role model.
Mm.
And as I was growing up, he taught me something.
Mm.
He said, nobody's coming.
Yeah.
Nobody's coming to save you.
Yeah.
Right? And I've always carried that in everything that I did. I always did it with the attitude of nobody's coming to save me.
Yeah.
Nobody's coming. I must do it by myself. But I've come to learn that he's here.
Mm.
He's here to save me.
Mm.
You know, it's not always true that nobody's coming. Yes, there are certain things that are within my control.
Yeah.
And in that regard, nobody's coming.
Yeah.
That which God has enabled me to do, he expects me to do it. Nobody's coming.
Mm.
But that which I cannot do, he's here to do.
Mm.
So those are my parting shots.
Sure.
God is real.
He is so real.
Mm. He's real.
I remember when I lost a bursary because of my beliefs, right? So I studied mining engineering. And as you may or may not know, mines work on the clock. There's no Sabbath. There's no nights.
No, absolutely.
It works around the clock. And so one of the bursaries that the person who interviewed me even wanted me to skip a stage because he was just so impressed with me. He's like, you have to work here. But when they sat around the table, they were like, she couldn't come to the interview on Sabbath. How much more when we do employer, are we going to have a problem
exactly.
with her?
Yeah.
Are we going to have a problem with her? And that's how I lost the scholarship. I remember crying so much. Like, maybe God doesn't want me to be an engineer. Maybe I shouldn't go to university. Oh, woe is me. And one of the ladies who heard me cry said to me, hey, do you remember David in the Bible? I'm like, yeah. Tell me about David a little bit. And before I could even speak, she said, remember that David was running for his life because Saul was after him. I'm like, yeah. And then she says, did that change the fact that David was still anointed king?
Yeah.
Ooh.
That's deep.
I stopped crying.
Yeah, that's deep.
I stopped crying because I thought, do you really believe? Do you really want to reduce God to the fact or the idea and your own false idea that the struggle in your life is a sign that his hand is not on you and that his way will prevail anyway? And so when I hear you speak, I remember that moment because there were so many touch points in your story where you could have been like, ah, you know, felt disempowered, completely disengaged, chose to take the easy route of, I'm not wanted in this world. It's not for people like me. It's not for girls. It's not for black girls. But you chose to persist. And more than anything, you said, oh, there's a problem. Oh, guess what? The solution is coming. The no one is coming that your dad instilled in you. You were like, oh, I will be the one that's coming to solve this problem. And now the world is better because the things you stumbled on and the things you found difficulty on or in, we, as people who are born free, get to walk freely into. We don't even know the tears and the blood and the sweat that happened. We can just walk because it is women like you who crawled and fought and had their hands scraped and their knees scraped just so that we could walk into these doors. And so in this moment, I really want to honor you and thank you and perhaps let you know that once upon a time, I wanted to be a psychologist too. But that's a conversation we can have on another day on a different platform. But your work is really appreciated. The work you do in corporates, the work you do outside of corporates, you have been and I know will continue to change the world through your mind, your gift, and just your presence. And I thank you for coming onto this platform and sharing yourself and your journey with us.
Thank you. And may all glory go to God for his goodness to me. Thank you.
Ah, have a lovely evening.
And same to you. Thank you so much for having me on your show.
Cheers. Do you see why I love Thursdays? Do you see? Oh, man. I hope that inspired you and I hope it lit a fire in your belly. I nearly said the other B, but I don't want to be fired like that lady in the consultancy. I am Nompumelelo Mbonane, and I hope you've just made sense of your life, man. I hope this has really put your life in full view and made you think differently about the areas you wanted to give up on, give up in, when they could literally be what you use to offer others a breakthrough. We do this again next week, Monday. But I know that because I'm not the one in control and because life doesn't stop when the show is not on air, you will receive fresh mercies tomorrow. For now, ciao. It's been a great week. Thank you, everybody.
You are tuned into Adventist World Radio, powered by SID Media.